Hi there, everybody. Welcome to another nominees panel. I haven't done many of these this year. Actually, I haven't done any of them. This is the first one, and it's going to be a grab bag of nominees where I've just gathered people who wanted to talk about something, and we're going to talk about our favorites in basically the prose categories, maybe touching on a couple other categories as well. And I've assembled a panel of previous guests and one not new guest to the podcast, but new to the discussion panels. So returning guests, we have Juan San Miguel. Hi, Juan.
Hey, Seth. Hi, everybody.
And we have Sarah.
Hey, everybody.
And Ivor.
Hi, yeah.
Coming to us from Scotland, correct?
That is correct, yes. All right. On the West Coast this time.
Yes, and site of next year's, well, not exactly site, but at least country of next year's Worldcon, which is exciting. My wife and I are already planning on coming over for that, so that should be fun. And then a new voice to the podcast, but a new face, if I ever post this to YouTube, which no promises, but I may do it, is Lacey Jane Wolf. Hi. How are you doing?
Hi, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you. And this, some of this came out of, I had posted on the Patreon site, if anybody wanted to be on panels, and Lacey Jane had mentioned, I'd love to talk about the novels. And I said, well, I feel like I've spent all my bullets on that one on the narrated podcast that I did. But then I thought, you know what? I bet I know how we can do this. Just let people come and talk about whatever they want to talk about. So we're going to work our way through prose categories, going from short story up to novel. Some of the panelists may or may not have things to say on any of the stories, or for instance, I haven't read any of the novellas. So I will sit back and just sort of facilitate for those ones. But we will start with short stories. So would anybody like to start by introducing what short story they enjoyed? Now, Juan, I know that you've talked about all the prose categories
right,
with your book club, right?
Yes, I talked about it with my science fiction club, and also it was brought. I worked with the library system, so if anybody wanted to join us on it, so I can speak on any of them. But I can open up with the story which won the Nebula this year, The Rabbit Test.
Okay,
which is a no holds bar response to the Dobbs decision of the Supreme Court decision of last year's, and imagining what kind of world it is. And also taking a look at the history of reproductive rights, I believe not only in our country, but in the world. So it is a very, it's a very meaty story. It's a very intense story. It is also a podcast. It's from Uncanny Magazine, and you can find it. It's being read by Erica Ensign, who one time Lonely or Hugo for my annual Hugo picture, because she... because Uncanny won semi-prosy, and she got to get a trophy for 1 year. So it's an incredible story. I think it sums it up. If we follow two generations of women in a future that is now being decided by Dobbs,
right? And even more than that, there's a technological quote advance, right, that monitors female fertility.
I forgot about that. I'm trying to do broad. You got to sometimes get me for details because I'm always paranoid of spoiling something.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Sometimes I'm very broad. But no, that is true. They create an app which can monitor young women's, or I think all women's biological functions, and can alert when they're pregnant, and maybe not to the people they want them to know.
Right. And it's pregnant. The kind of thing that seems like, wow, that's such a huge invasion of privacy. And it's trying to get the reader to understand, well, maybe we shouldn't be trying to control women's fertility at all.
Correct.
Interesting thing in this story for me are the little historical vignettes that show how much freer women were, ironically, 400 years ago. And that's kind of nuts to me.
Oh, yeah. And also, it's even more I don't think in the prose story, and I know you read it in prose, in the audio version, I think she actually uses a gavel or a gavel noise to kind of switch from the main story to one of the vignettes. So it gets more it adds intensity, in my opinion, to it.
Yeah, I thought that was an excellent short story. I also enjoyed On the Razor's Edge. That was a kind of an exciting one. This is one where there's a fire aboard the International Space Station, and Chinese astronauts from the Chinese station are attempting to render aid using some modern or futuristic technology. That one was a lot of fun. And that one was from Ji Yong Bo.
Yep. This is one of the stories from a Chinese author, and it was translated for the packet. It's a very good story. It feels very analog. And what I mean analog, the magazine, because analog is still the most hardest of the hard science fiction magazines. You get the Bolts. And this is a very, I don't think there's anything impossible in this story. If I remember correctly, it's all plausible and everything could happen. And it's just a great, good old fashioned hard science fiction story.
One other one I wanted to highlight is DIY by John Wiswell, which is a fantasy one where guys are trying to essentially open source through the use of magic the production of water for, you know, drought areas. And of course, authorities are trying to take it over.
Yeah. I should mention this is freely available on Tor, the website. If you just search for it, you'll find it. And yeah, it's an anti-establishment. The gentlemen involved could not get into the traditional magic school, so they decide to figure it out for themselves, do some amateur science, and try to solve a drought in their town. No, very good story. John Wiswell has been doing some great work in the last couple of years. He's won some awards, and he's a name I look forward to when I see him on tour. I guess I will. If I have one more story to pick, I would probably pick Zurong on Mars, which is Regina Kanyo Wang from the magazine Frontiers. That was an interesting story. It's essentially takes a traditional Chinese myth, and instead of gods, we have AIs. We go into the far future. Mankind has gone post-human, and the AI on Mars, who helped run Mars, has nothing to do. So it decides to essentially run everything and finds out about himself. It's the and this is an interesting refreshing because I am getting frustrated, even though I understand why people use the term AI for some of the stuff going on now. But to me, it's data mining. And sure, this is truly about an AI who can think for itself and is trying to figure out what does it do when all the humans go away and it meets another AI and what happens. And Zurong is named after a god of fire in Chinese mythology. So
I looked up, I think it's Zurong, but
Zurong. Oh yeah. Thank you.
I was looking up pinyin pronunciations the other day, just because I knew there were names on here. That's an interesting one. It actually reminded me a little bit of Colossus, the D.F. Jones book that became Colossus, the Forbin Project, the 70s movie. Just because there was an AI built into a mountain, more or less. And that was why it reminded me of it. But yeah, that's an interesting one where it's building itself up, trying to essentially add to its processing capability, and then discovers another one. And that's another thing that reminds me of Colossus. But yeah, that's a good one. There's two other stories, Resurrection by Ren Qing and The White Cliff by Lu Ban. Neither of these made much of an impression on me, actually.
Resurrection I kind of like because, well, the idea is resurrection is if the government is trying to essentially resurrect people, and essentially they send to a distraught mother, "Hi, we've resurrected your son. Let's see how he works out. This is still in the beta test, and we'll take him back in 2 weeks.
You get a 14-day free trial of your resurrected son.
Son, and it is a little bit more darker than the way that we make it sound. I mean, but is it a good idea to resurrect people? I mean, I think that's the big idea behind this story, and maybe not. I think it asks that question.
Yeah.
And as for the White Cliff, I think it's asking, you know, some very big questions about how to process death. With their big ideas, if there's a new device to help the terminally ill process death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, it's also a bittersweet tale, very deep tale. Also available, unfortunately, only in the Hugo packet translated.
Yeah.
And the translations are decent. For the official translations were pretty good. Just want to say that.
Yeah, there was one of them that I found, I think Resurrection, I found a little clunky. It was a little hard to read. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to novelettes. We'll try and get some other people involved here, because that's the thing with a panel like this. Not everybody's read all the same things. So novelettes, Sarah, why don't you lead off with something that you liked?
Okay. I really liked, "If You Find Yourself Speaking to God, Address God with the Informal You" by John Chu.
It's a great title.
Yeah, it is. So what if you figured out this really, really hot guy at the gym was actually the vigilante superhero who's been attacking racists that the cops are after? And what if you then realize, hey, the really hot guy at the gym, who happens to be a vigilante, seems to think I'm kind of interesting, seems to want to spend a little time with me. Mm-hmm. So this tale deals with kind of upending some of the light-centered superhero tales. It's a spicy tale, and it's steamy and thoughtful at the same time because of some of the things it gets into with identity and choices we make in representing ourselves and choices we make in being in the world and what to do about things that are going on.
Yeah.
The title, I think, is a reference to languages, non-English languages, which commonly have use of informal and formal you pronouns, or to put it another way, personal and impersonal.
Right. We used to have those in English. We had thee and thou and...
That's right. Thee and thou and thine used to be used for the familiar and very personal relationships, which a lot of people, because they've read the King James Bible, it looks more formal.
Yes.
But those are actually the very personal things that you would say to a loved one, thee and thine and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked it. I thought it moved along well. It had a little bit of city living and gym rat life and what that atmosphere is like. So,
And just the violence against Asians as well. Which absolutely is shockingly common.
Yes, yes. It doesn't shy back from that, mm-hmm. Even though it celebrates love and attraction and hotness. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a really well-balanced, well-told tale.
He had a pet name for the superhero, something of Finland. Tom of Finland?
I think that's right. Who's in gay culture, this... Yeah. Big, bulky, attractive guy. So I think maybe that's what that was about.
Yeah. And then, of course, the races start calling the superhero the Great Wall because he's Asian.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think that you did a really good job with that one. I liked it a lot. It was my favorite.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one as well. I had to look up the Tom of Finland thing. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. a very sort of overly idealized pictures of men.
And yes.
I like to do just a little bit of, if you're a closeted superhero who has an amazing physique, mm-hmm. Part of your disguise is going to the gym because you have to be seen working out. Otherwise, how do you explain that body?
Right. And he's doing other things. I mean, it's sort of along the Superman line of really people couldn't figure out it was the same guy just because he wore glasses and a suit. But
in this case, it's a sweatshirt.
What are you expecting to see? This case, a sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. And also he changes his voice.
Yes.
So he's got kind of an everyday voice for, at the gym. Hey, do you want me to spot you? That kind of thing. And then in the action hero, he has this deep, deep.
Yes, it is I.
Yes. Yes. So it's a very knowledgeable, well-written story.
Yeah. I enjoyed that one. Anybody else have novelettes they want to talk about?
I guess the other one story I really did like was the A Dream of Electric Mothers by Wole Talabi, mm-hmm. From the Africa Risen collection. And it's in the future. It's actually set. I found out it's set in an alternate reality, I believe. And essentially, a republic uses a system of store mines for their government leaders to confer on issues of state, and a general joins other ministers to determine a course of action that could possibly lead to war. And during the session, it becomes more personal for the general. And again, I don't want to give away anything, but I always did like this classic idea. I mean, even Doctor Who has used it, the idea of storing minds to form some type of sophisticated computer system. But this shows how this shows the little picture rather than the big picture.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it reminds me a little bit of in Star Trek, the Vulcans have some sort of heritage that they can access the minds of the ancestors, more or less. And this is sort of a technological version of that.
Yeah, I think on a tangent, Vonda McIntyre had to come up with that because I think they had to explain, or somebody had to explain, why are they bringing Spock back in the third movie, you know, why did they have to bring him back, or at least part of him back anyway? So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I also liked Murder by Pixel, Crime and Responsibility in the Digital Darkness by S.L. Huang. That was a fascinating one. Just it asks the question, why don't we do a better job of policing bullying and that kind of stuff online, by essentially making it so that the FBI is interested in this apparently AI that's going around and bullying people into suicide or other things. And one of the people who's sort of suspected of having created that AI says, why are you so interested in catching this computer? Why don't you go after the humans who do these kind of things? And it's a good question.
Yeah. Looking at those two books, those two stories together, the approaches to AI, they are getting into some territory about the different facets of AI. Like Juan was mentioning earlier, the group mind kind of thing, which I haven't seen as much of lately. Mm-hmm. I agree that earlier, maybe 15, 20 years ago or longer ago, there was more of that sort of group mind AI, but I haven't seen it as much lately. So it's interesting that he brings it back. Talabi is an engineer pretty knowledgeable. And so I thought that was an interesting look at it. And similar to some discussions we've had before, the line between, well, this is a construct that has the memories of various ancestors, but how much is it really them? How much am I just kind of fooling myself into having a conversation? And is that good sometimes? Not necessarily a bad thing, but better if you're aware what's happening. And then the S.L. Wing, Huang novelette, I noticed that she mixed in a lot of true, correct historical and technological information about actual stalking against actual people, actual bullying, cyber stalking, etc.
Actual chatbots that were trained on Twitter and became
racist
she's trolls.
She's got both the cyber stalking stuff and stuff about chatbots. Yeah. And it is very worrying about what's going to be happening. When there are certainly some bad actors out there now who are stalking perfectly nice people just because they think it's fun or funny. And when they start leveraging chatbots, it's just going to be awful. And I am glad that some police and law enforcement agencies are starting to take it more seriously, but some are just not and saying, well, just don't go online then.
Right. Yeah. That's the easy solution.
It's not very realistic for a lot of us anymore. Mm-hmm. So I thought both of those had interesting takes on where are we really going?
There's the additional wrinkle in that story too, of the counterexamples of this chatbot AI being a great comfort to people. And so who knows who's controlling it? And the story doesn't answer that. So,
yeah. Murder by Pixel is also a vigilante story. Like the If You Find Yourself Speaking to God novelette. And in some ways you sympathize a lot with the vigilantes, but you look at someone else could take those same tools and just harass the life literally out of someone they just think it's funny to pick on, or they think politically they ought to put this person or this type of person down. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the novelettes there.
Yeah. That's all the ones that I read. So if anybody wants to talk about any of the others, go for it.
Well, I'll mention that I also read We Built This City by Marie Vibert, which is roughly Union formation in space. I've read a collection called Menials about, people out in the space station, maintaining the domes, et cetera, is the focus of this one. But it's on a planet where the corporations are just tightening and tightening and tightening and saying to the workers, well, you have to keep working or the city will fall. It's your fault, instead of actually letting them have lunch breaks and, that kind of thing, which, in a way that could be set now among, say, striking train workers, right. Who were quashed and that sort of thing. Or there's a lot of striking activity going on now, and some of it's been very successful. Yay. And some of it has not been. So she gets into some of the, you know, it's going to be even tougher when we can't even just breathe air without having to pay for it. Yeah. Right now, we can at least breathe air without paying for it. And depending on where you live, you can drink water without having to pay for it or not pay much for it. And in space, it's going to be more precarious. And, you know, unless you go in with protections built in, it's going to be more dangerous and more difficult to resist. So, so I thought I might have liked to see a little more done with that, but I did think it was good. I liked the, you know, close up of the labor and the mindset of people of, you know, hesitating and, you know, you're with me, right? Are you, you know, the hesitancy and the people dynamic, she did do good stuff with that, about just how hard it is to try and figure out, is this it? Is this the time?
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on novelettes?
I'd like to say something briefly about at least the last two. The Difference Between Love and Time by Catherine N. Valenti. This is a great surrealistic story where somebody falls in love with the space-time continuum, and it crosses over all frontiers. And yet it's relatable. It's a brilliant surrealistic story. Catherine Valente is one of our more talented writers. It appeared in an anthology called Someone in Time, but it also they made it available for free on Tor.com. So if anybody wants to read that. And also Murder by Pixel, if you find yourself talking to God and We Built This City are available as podcasts from their mutual magazines if you want to check them out in that way. The other story is The Space-Time Painter, which did not get released in a translation, but some of us figured out some ways to translate it. Might not have been the best way. It proves the fact that we still need human beings to do proper translations, or at least understandable translations. But yeah. It's essentially a police investigator investigating some strange happenings at a storage facility in the Forbidden City, and it deals with an artist from the past and how he's made somehow an ability to make an impression on the future. It's an interesting story. It's part of a series. I believe if I read the footnotes correctly again, it's the police detective shows up in some other works of the author. Oh, I should mention the author's name. It's Haya, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And it appeared in Galaxy's Edge. So no, it's a very interesting kind of science. This is something I'm probably going to use magazines to compare some of these. This is something I can imagine easily appearing in Asimov's. It's there, or Uncanny. It's their kind of type of story, because there's a little bit mystery and maybe the science is a little bit hazy in some places, but it's consistent with itself.
Mm. Alrighty, shall we move on to the novellas? Ivor, I think you have some novellas you want to talk about. This is a category I have not read at all, so I will be looking for reading recommendations from any of you.
Well, I'll start with A Mirror Mended, which I actually read last year, long before I knew it was going to be nominated for this. It is not going to win. I'm just going to say that. It's not going to win, because it does have flaws. But I actually blame you for this, Seth. This is all your fault. I used to start and read all these as like science fiction. And now I've gone down the rabbit hole, literally, of fantasy and horror and more absurd or exponential science fiction, etc. And I blame you totally for that. But the actual story is pure fantasy. It's it tickled me because it just reminded me of the fairy tales that I got told as a kid, but it was the reverse. The main character is particularly unlikable at the beginning, I have to say, from my point of view as a reader. And she is the kind of answering voice behind the mirror, mirror on the wall. And she appears and saves the day, sort of thing. And rather than saves the day by being the action, she actually turns people's thinking. And I think that was a great twist. It is not the best story, novella that I've read. But it definitely took me down a different path. And I, again, blame you totally, Seth.
This is related to A Spindle Splintered from last year?
Yes, it is. Okay. I quite like the idea Now, I like her writing. I have actually picked up some more of her stuff I need to get through, and it is very much down that kind of more fantasy fairy tale vein. I have actually started the next story that she did based on that same theme about the mirror, but I forgot what it's called. Beg my forgiveness on that one. But yeah, it's purely based on just taking the fairy tale concept, turning it on its head, and making it very insane to the reader, and also pulling you in to look at the hero. Actually, the heroine is not the main character. The heroine is everybody else who takes on the patriarchy, as it really is, in that particular story. But yes, I found it amusing, and it was just a good story to read. It won't win. It does have flaws. That's the only problem I would say. There's a couple of writing flaws in there, which I picked up on. I thought, yeah, that would need to be tightened up on. But yeah, I loved it in that respect. It made me smile, laugh, and be entertained.
Awesome. Sarah, I think you had something to say.
I just can't remember the name of the author. I did read the Spindle Splintered one. So I also liked that. Okay. But I can't quite bring it, unless it's Alex Arrow, but I'm not, that could be totally wrong. Oh,
you're getting a thumbs up from Juan and Ivor.
Go memory.
Yeah. Any other novellas? Juan, do you have one you want to talk about, or Sarah?
Yes. What Moves the Dead by T. Kingfisher. She's also Ursula Vernon. I think Ursula Vernon is her given name. Mm-hmm. This was a great take, great new take on Edgar Allan Poe's gothic horror story. Speaking of horror, The Fall of the House of Usher. The cover gives away part of the story for those who can actually understand what they're seeing when they look at it, which is not everyone. You can see there's sort of a rabbit there and something, or a hare, pardon me. But something's going on with it. And some people will be able to see what's going on with it, and other people won't understand what this image is. I love Barnes & Noble's blurb on it. It says, "Let this cover of What Moves the Dead explode your eyes and brains, and to assure you, the read lives up to the cover." So in the story, Alex, a retired soldier, visits their childhood friends, Madeline and Roderick, in Ruritania, good old Ruritania. So Madeline's in poor health, Roderick's in poor spirits, and most of the locals don't really care for these gentry in among them. But the creepy developments and the side characters give the story a lot of life and energy. So if you like creeping around in old mansions and wondering what's up with the weird wildlife, this story is for you. So I just loved it to pieces. I'm wearing a little bunny hat in honor of a hare hat in honor of it. And I have a couple of comps, but Ivor, you wanted to say something now?
Yeah, I was going to say, but just as you were talking about there about that, it's also the fact that it's the kind of pronouns, etc. Introduced that element as well of, like, I didn't realize till at least about 10 pages in that character, the main character, was a woman. Did it matter? No.
Right. There's a thing there with gender and soldiers, and it's a little complicated, and the book does it better. My sister, Trish Manson, says that Vernon is going to write a sequel now, not set in Ruritania, but Further Adventures of Alex Easton, Retired Soldier, of they, them. There's five genders in this story, but you know, the gothic story moves right along, and you can keep up with the other parts as needed. I did enjoy it a lot. The whole Ruritania thing, that's the Prisoner of Zenda country. It's a fake European country that writers and academics I've seen actually use it as hypothetical European country, maybe with some monarchy remnants and so on. The other two stories, if you like this, if you're into this House of Usher thing and stories of decay, I also recommend an old one by Ray Bradbury called Usher 2, which is set on Mars, where someone has built a house. And just more recently, Tom Doyle, who's a Maryland writer that I know. He writes the American Craftsman series, and he's done a lot on Poe and other old stories, Nathaniel Hawthorne, mixing it into current stories. And he's definitely got some stuff with Roderick and Madeline, further adventures. So any other novellas anyone wanted to talk about?
Can I just add on to the fact that with this one, if you listen to it on Audible, the gentleman who has read it is an Andy Ingallis. It does a wonderful accent as well throughout it. It is highly entertaining and well worth the one credit if you're on Audible, if you can find it elsewhere. But it really brings the story alive. It's probably, when I read it, I didn't really get the same gist as I did when I listened to it. It's really excellent.
Yeah, there's a couple of side characters who add, mm-hmm. especially to people who know anything about Beatrix Potter. I'll just stop at that.
Oh, okay. I just looked up that the book cover, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, other novella.
Yeah, Even Though I Knew the End by C.L. Polk. Again, it's kind of fantasy. It's queer. It's really entertaining. Is it science fiction? Is it fantasy? I don't know. What I found was it was a very, very well layered with imagery through the pages about what I consider, it was like 1920s Berlin in a kind of magical New York where warlocks wandered the street and the police were unafraid of them, and a night vampire or the white vampire was haunting the streets. But it was actually more about the whole Christopher Marlowe element to it, that very thick classic noir detective element, the kind of laid on about the broads and the dames, etc., etc. But it was all from that female perspective. And again, is it a classic Hugo? Well, maybe not. But from the point of view of what it introduces you to as a male, an old one, I find it really quite enlightening to be able to use it to read novellas like this that kind of bring me into a different thing and challenge those prejudices and think, actually, do you know what? This is really entertaining. This is cracking writing. It doesn't matter what the character is. It doesn't matter on the sexuality. It's a cracking story. Mm-hmm. So that was my point. And that's the one thing I would say about this entire thing over the past few years, especially these discussion panels, is I'm scribbling notes and I go away and read more and get introduced to so much more stuff that's out there that I never would normally go and find.
Right. All right. Anybody else? Juan, you have anything in the novellas you wanted to highlight?
Well, I can highlight the other two stories. I mean, Where Do Drowned Girls Go, which is a continuation of Seanan McGuire's Wayward Girls series, which I actually like and won the Best Series Award last year. And this is an interesting take because one of the young people who was at the school, the Eleanor West School for Wayward Children, which helped people recover from going to their secondary world as children and come back, decides that unfortunately the school is not meeting her needs. She went to a mermaid world and she still hears calls. So she goes to another school, which is using more forceful techniques. It's called Whitehorn, and they're more brutal. They want you to forget about the other world. And is this a good idea? Will this help Cora? Is there something else going on with the school? And this is a little bit different from the other books. I think there was never an implication of a competing school or a competing philosophy on how to recover from a secondary world. Did anybody else check it out?
I've read several of the Seanan McGuire, you know, portal books, the ones about recovering portal refugees. I read three or four of them. I'm interested to hear that this one is still looking at the problem, but with a different school and different characters.
Oh, yeah. And Ogres is by Adrian Tchaikovsky. This is a world run by ogres. These are beings that are physically bigger than humans. And a human decides to rebel against the ogres, and he escapes his village and goes on a journey, and he discovers there's a secret of their world. And it's a great idea. Adrian Tchaikovsky has been writing some really great stuff. He's also up for a Best Series Award for his science fiction series, The Children of Time. I found it kind of engaging, particularly because I think he sets the seed that there's something sort of twist or the turnaround at the end. And also, I should One of the interesting challenges about the or not challenges, I think the novella category in recent years has been kind of dominated by the publisher Tor.com, a side publisher of Tor. This year they got 4 out of the 6 slots. I just wanted to note that because that's been something that's been commentating. I mean, Tor.com has helped revive the novella. I mean, I try to broaden my reading. I do a big short fiction binge between Thanksgiving and March. And the thing is, if everything goes right, Asimov and Analog releases their reader polls before March, so I can sample their novellas for. They put out all the work that their readers think are the top 5 for final voting, and I try to check those out just to try to get a mix. But it's an interesting mix that we got 2 selections because I think the last year, maybe the last 2 years, they were all dominated by Tor.com. Mm. Although to be fair, all the books are variety. It's not the same type of book. It's not the same book. Oh, and also I just realized I would have forgotten to mention the Niveau book Into the Riverlands, which is the 3rd of a series, the Singing Hills cycle. I didn't read the 2nd. I read the 1st, and she does very good to set up that you don't need the 2nd or you don't need a lot of intense knowledge. We follow a wandering cleric called Chi, I believe that's how you spell it or pronounce it, if please correct me if I'm wrong, and his parrot, Almost Brilliant, and they go on a journey where they're accompanied by a pair of young women and an older couple, and they face challenges and they exchange stories on their trip. It's kind of like the Canterbury Tales or Hyperion, and it was an engaging story. Niveau has been doing novellas. She actually published a novel last year about old Hollywood and a magical setting, The Siren Queen, which I'm surprised didn't make the novel list. But it's a very, she does very strong stories.
Okay. Well, Lacey Jane has been sitting on the bench, just chugging Gatorade, ready to come in, put me in coach. And we're finally 2 novels. I think I learned that if I'm going to do one like this, I need to just do, Juan, do you have anything you want to talk about? Sarah, do you have anything? And just kind of not stick to the categories, just in case we have this situation where somebody hasn't read the shorter stuff. But Lacey Jane, novels, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, let's see. I'd love to talk about one of my favorite novels from the nominees, Nettle and Bone by T. Kingfisher, same author that Sarah mentioned earlier and that did What Moves the Dead. I've read, I think, all but one of the Hugo novel winners. And of course, there's not a lot of fantasy on the list, but this, I think, would be a great complement to past winners. And I loved, similar to some of the other stories we've discussed, it's turning some parts of the fairy tale genre on their head. And I thought, although that many authors have tackled that topic, this one was fun and entertaining and very surprising. So I really enjoyed reading this one and would highly recommend it.
Yeah. I liked that one an awful lot. I liked the main character. She's trying to save her sister, and she doesn't even like her sister that much, but she doesn't have any other sisters left from events in the story. And this is what she's got. And she's trying, she's smart and determined. And there are some hilarious characters that she meets with, but like a lot of Verne's work, there's humor, but there's also some very serious dark stuff that some of these modern fairy stories grapple with a little more directly. Domestic abuse, also from older fairy stories, the fact that these bargains with fairies can go really, really badly. I think that was a really good mix. I thought she did a great job with it. I liked it. I enjoyed reading it a lot. But there are parts, there's a little body horror, if not body horror, certainly brace yourself. It starts out with a bang. If you can get through that part, there's still other different horrible things.
Exactly. This was my favorite of the novel nominees this year.
Really?
And it's That's not, wonderful. If you've listened to my podcast, you know that I'm more of a science fiction fan than a fantasy fan, but this one really worked for me. I liked the length of it, especially. Did not overstay overstay its welcome. The prose is so clear that there was one moment that I had trouble picturing something, like the demon wheel, or I can't remember exactly what the, I had a little trouble with that, but that was toward the end of the book. But, you know, the fact that there's a dog made of bones, and like none of that was confusing to me. It was, really, really enjoyed it. Anybody else comments on other novels?
I thought The Daughter of Dr. Moreau by Sylvia Moreno Garcia was really good, but some people are going to bounce right off it.
Yeah.
So I want to say that up front. An overview without spoilers. This is a modern take on H.G. Wells' The Island of Dr. Moreau. It's set in the 1890s like the original book, but it's on the Yucatan Peninsula, mostly switching narratives between Carlotta, who's the daughter of Dr. Moreau, and Montgomery, who's a scientist, and Montgomery, his head servant and foreman guy.
Yes.
So Carlotta, headstrong teenager, full of troublemaking hormones, but she's also smart. She helps her father in the lab and takes care of his human-animal hybrids. Montgomery is a weak man in some ways, but he's also capable in some ways, empathetic and educated. And his perspective adds a lot on Carlotta, on Dr. Moreau's work, and on economics and local history, getting into labor and all of that. So the hybrids are destined for manual labor to solve capitalist and colonial problems of unenthusiastic local laborers and Mayan rebels. But many of the hybrids can speak, some start to think for themselves. So this book digs into a lot of contemporary issues. You know, Wells, when he wrote it, was also grappling with contemporary for his time issues of vivisection and all of that. Moreno Garcia is looking at other dimensions as well. She does a great job balancing dreamy jungle scenery, you know, floating around in a kind of a cistern. There was a name for it, but I don't remember the Spanish.
I can't remember what the name
was. So anyway, so she balances this dreamy jungle scenery, a little bit of body horror with all of these hybrids and things going on with them, and nuanced characters and nuanced interactions between them. You know, a lot of people aren't really going to like the main characters, but they are doing really interesting things talking with each other. And as the book develops, they definitely have character arcs and are learning things, you know, and in some cases confronting things about themselves. And it steams up into, it's not just a thinky book. It turns into a lot of explosive plot developments. So I think it's well worth reading. I would actually put it as the best of the finalists this year. That is the same author who wrote Mexican Gothic. She's been doing some really interesting work.
Yeah.
So, I gave the caveats. If you can't stand weak main characters or teenagers who don't really get it at first, at least, you know, you may not be able to make it through this one, but I thought it was very good.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one. And I think it's probably a good idea to emphasize that this is not a sequel or sidequel to The Island of Dr. Moreau. It really is a reimagining of it and putting it in a different place. And it's an interesting place to put it in the Yucatan Peninsula during the, I think that it was called the Caste War.
That's right. And I did really, really like how much Garcia got into, well, if you're paying attention, there's a part where Montgomery is discussing with some other people what's going on in local politics and history and so on. And he's clearly, you know, he's not from around here, but he has paid attention to what's really happening. And, you know, other people have these airy ideas of, you know, these locals just don't get it. And the, you know, it's all their fault that there's all this trouble, you know, all right. So, yeah, if you're a little bit of an economics geek or a labor relations geek, or, you know, there's definitely a lot of meat in here, but there's also an adventure story, you know.
Yeah.
Seth and Sarah, did either of you reread The Island of Dr. Moreau before reading The Daughter of Dr. Moreau? I did not do that. And I wonder if I would have had a different experience of the book if I had. Did either of you do that?
No.
Not recently before.
I have to admit, I've actually never read that. I've read quite a bit of Wells, but I have not read that one. I saw the disaster of a movie in the 90s.
Michael York one?
Val Kilmer, David Thewlis.
Oh, okay, that one. Michael York would be earlier.
Marlon Brando one, which it's an interesting movie just because it was such a tortured production. And there are documentaries that are really interesting about why it was such a nightmare.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So I've also seen some of several of the movie versions. You know, it got started being made into movies in like the 1920s, at least, if not earlier, black and white, silent. So I did go off and read the entire Wikipedia entry on.
I did that as well.
Which is there's a lot of information in there. So I went and read that and read some excerpts. I was interested in what some of the differences were. This character of the daughter, that's a bit different from in the book. She's brought out earlier. She has more agency. And in the story, she's not precisely the daughter. So there's things that are mixed up. I mean, in the original story, she's the daughter, but there's, this was Moreno Garcia mixing it up to tell a little bit different, you know, and it is interesting. You know, one of the things the book does a little bit is, a little bit of Rashomon, between the characters. So one character will, so that's a Japanese movie where you see a thing that happened through like eight different characters' eyes, the same event happening again. And in this book, you'll see a scene and then the narrative will shift to someone else's and they'll see part of the same scene, but they're noticing different things. So it's not just this story, but the same action, but with this other character's emotional interpretation. They're literally seeing different things.
Yeah.
Because they're coming in with different biases and expectations, but you can tell, oh, this is the part where they have the fight, you know, and there's I just found that really interesting in how she was showing you. It really matters where you're coming from every step you take, because it affects what you see, what jumps out at you. You know, there's a thing where one of the hybrid people who's kind of been brought up with with the daughter is telling her something. And the teenage girl is all like, you're always telling me I'm stupid or something. And, you know, the hybrid is like, you're just not seeing, you know, and then they're both seeing different things. So I thought her play with the narrative and the point of view shifting and what is told in each different character's narration, I thought that was really interesting as a reader looking at that writing, crafting, when I noticed what she was doing. Mm-hmm. It may be a little confusing to some readers. Did we move back in time? No, it's just a narrative shift in point of view, and it's picking up at a slightly different place. Mm-hmm. There was a lot I liked a lot about this book.
Nice. I loved that part too, Sarah, the technique. I didn't know that word for it, so I'm glad to know a new term. And I agree with you that one of the strengths of the book was in showing the horror of everyday life, or the horror of real life or real history in this case, similar to what Seth and Juan were saying about the rabbit test short story, it sounded like, where you're showing the naivete of a privileged youth, a privileged person, and how we can, you know, in our privilege, overlook horrors that are happening every day to people that we love and that we know, we think we know well. And I thought that was a real strength of the book. I enjoyed that part.
Yeah. Juan, any novels that you wanted to talk about?
Well, two of my favorites of the ones not spoken of. And first is The Kaiju Preservation Society by John Scalzi. Mm-hmm. Now, Open Arms, I'm a big fan of John Scalzi. I I think I bought everything he's done. I follow him closely. Now he admits that this is a pop song of a book. Now, a friend of mine pointed out that some people might not notice. Kaiju is the Japanese word for monster. So we're talking about Godzilla-like monsters. And apparently, a young man finds himself out of work due to COVID, and he finds an interesting job opportunity. Apparently, we have discovered in the 60s, a parallel world, a parallel Earth, which is inhabited by giant monsters. And after 50 years, we still haven't figured them out yet. In fact, there's a scene where essentially somebody drops in a load of papers about a couple of phone books high to show that all the research is, and they still haven't completely understood how their biology works. But their job is to observe. They're professional scientists. I like the work environment. That's what gets me. It feels like my own work environment. As I was telling Ivor before I work a bureaucratic government job, and I don't get to observe giant monsters. But it seems like, you know, the mentality of going into work. I mean, the main character enjoys their work and is being fulfilled. Now, the conflict in it is that they're observing one of the creatures is pregnant and is about to lay their eggs, and they want to observe the cycle, the birth cycle. But then the creature and the eggs seem to disappear, and that's the mystery and the conflict of that story. Now, John describes it as a pop song because he felt that he was being very light, and some people agree. I think he does tackle along themes, and I don't want to say, and unfortunately, I don't feel comfortable saying what some of those themes are because it involves the twist and what's really going on with who took or what took one of the creatures. But I think it is a deep, I think he's selling himself short. I think it's an ambitious, novel. Yeah. And I would also like to bring up the Spare Man because I think it's a charming idea because the tagline is it's the thin man in space. And that's what Mary Robinette Kowal was going for, essentially. But she's focusing to the female from the wife's point of view. Essentially, you have a rich heiress who's going on her honeymoon with her husband. The heiress's name is Tesla Crane and her husband is Shouse Stewart. And they have a dog named Gimlet, and they go on a honeymoon cruise to Mars from the moon, and there's a murder, and the prime suspect is the husband, and Tesla's gotta solve the mystery so her husband doesn't go to jail or something worse. So, I love The Thin Man. In fact, I usually revisit it because I sometimes forget who the murderer is in the first movie, and it's a surprise. Sadly, unfortunately, the murderer in the second film is easy to remember because he would later become a big actor. I'm giving it away once you see it. But anyway, so I do love the books, and I think she got the rhythm right. She got the atmosphere right, and I'm hoping she does more of these. I don't think she's committed whether there will be more books in this series. Does anybody have anything to say about Kaiju or The Spare Man?
I think pop song is an apt description of the Kaiju Preservation Society. More than that, though, for me, it's a time capsule book. And it makes me worry that, you know, in 20 years, people are going to shake their heads at what's he even talking about there, because it references COVID and Netflix and Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and all that kind of stuff. It's so presently focused that I think it might have a hard time finding an audience in the future. But it is very funny, and certainly, if you need light reading, it's light reading with some depths here and there. I won't talk much about The Spare Man. That was in last place for me, and so I don't want to be negative, but it didn't really work for me. So I want to talk about Legends and Lattes, if nobody else wants to talk about it. Another sort of cozy fantasy story, right? I like the subtitle of the book. That's a novel of high fantasy and low stakes, which is very apt. It's just fun. I will say it's a book that if you read it in a coffee shop so that you can go get a pastry, because it will make you very hungry.
Dangerous.
Yeah. And I did. I read like the last 5 or 6 chapters in a coffee shop just so I could go get a cinnamon roll if I wanted. A lot of fun, a delightful read.
I enjoyed that one too, Seth. I thought it was a very cozy book. I did not think to read it in a coffee shop. What a brilliant idea! But I loved the waxing poetic about coffee and really dialing in on a feeling, the feeling you get when you're having a coffee or sitting down to relax over a pastry at a coffee shop. And I really enjoyed that part of it too.
Well, I like too, just the I can't remember the name of the rat that, Ratkin, is that?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in lots of fantasy books, there's some assumed knowledge that I don't generally have. And you know, I don't know about creature classes and D&D archetypes and that kind of stuff. It's not something that I have a view into in my life. And so I had to look up what a ratkin was. But I really enjoyed the fact that all of a sudden this ratkin gets to do what he loves and to create tasty things for other people. And I'm the primary cook in my house. And, it's a very good feeling when you make something and the people in your house go, "Ooh, that was good."
Yeah. Well, I have to, make that your comments, Seth, make me, think that the atmosphere in Legends and Lattes is sort of the opposite in Nona the Ninth, a quite disquieting, a little bit of the body horror. You're never quite sure you understand what's going on. You're always tilted off your guard. And another great book, I think, by Tamsin Muir. I really loved Gideon the Ninth. And so I was slightly angry at Nona the Ninth because it's holding her up from finishing the series. But it was interesting to see the way that she built the story out and she explains it, that, you know, it was a slight diversion from how she thought she was going to come in and wrap the story up, and it ended up on a kind of side story. So I thought it was really interesting, but disquieting and not cozy in any way.
Mm-hmm. Good segue, by the way.
Actually, it's kind of interesting because the things that stick into me are like the stuff about Nona and, you know, the kind of family atmosphere, which is kind of cozy. I mean, obviously, there's some intense parts in it. Intensity is the word I like to use for, I guess, scary bits and interesting bits. It's interesting she's extended the series because she got to the word count where made her eligible for best series, and it's in for best series. It's a complicated series. I consider it a challenging series. And I just think it's just her word choice, but it's more of my fault. I'm putting her in the same category that I would put Gene Wolfe, who is one person. Gary Wolfe, the reviewer, says that Gene Wolfe is not meant to be read; he's meant to be reread. And I guess I think you can say the same for the Locked Tomb series, which is what Nona's part of. It's a very complicated intense prose. At least I felt that for Harrow and Nona. Gideon was the easier one to get into, maybe because it's the introductory novel, or maybe I was just more focused that day. Who knows when I was reading the book, but I think it's a worthy series. But I also like Gothic imagery of any type. So it's got me there. So,
yeah, great points, Juan. I really agree with you about the reread and have reread the first two books and understood at least significantly more of Harrow than I did the first time around. Maybe not 100%. Maybe the third read is when you get to that. But yeah, great point too about that there are like elements of coziness and warmth in the little family unit, in the security and safety she feels with the people who are taking care of her and with her friend group. And that is such a harsh contrast against the world outside those rooms that she's in, you know, the city under siege and, you know, things kind of coming apart at the seams all around her. So I hadn't thought of that, though, about the coziness and the warmth and security of her family unit. It's a good point.
The only thing I can say about this one is it does not stand alone terribly well. I had not read any of the other in the series.
No.
So I had no idea.
Were you lost?
Yes. Yeah.
I honestly thought that it did stand alone. I mean, I thought the thing is, again, I had a rough time getting through Harrow. I remember a lot of the stuff that happened in Gideon, and Harrow, as I said, was a little rough going. So I think the thing is, if you focus on the stuff with Nona, only on the, I think the third act of the book, you know, you start to tie it in with the earlier stuff. But I think at the beginning, you're in the world But I don't think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I might have missed it, but I don't think there might be hints, but the main stuff in the series doesn't show up until the end of the book. So.
Right. There's just some of the kind of backgrounds of the necromancy stuff that's going on. That people can share a body, for instance. I didn't catch on to that until I was about halfway through the book and I went, I'm just going to read the Wikipedia article and then go back to reading. And because I know that I've missed stuff up to this point. And that was actually pretty helpful. I did in this one, I enjoyed the flashbacks to kind of the beginning of the necromancy. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I enjoyed that part too, and sort of trying to understand the person who creates necromancy, and you know, who is called God in the series,
right. Yeah.
Like what his motivations were, what existed before he was there, and I think those are really interesting questions to ask. And his kind of world weary. Perspective really being contrasted by Nona, who is shiny and new and knows nothing about the world and is experiencing it all for the first time. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else anybody wants to talk about?
Seth, I'd be interested to know what your opinions are on Best Fan Cast. I mean, is there anybody in there you fancy?
We should not go there.
I can't say
there.
That any of them ring a bell.
Best of luck to you, Seth.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
This is a great podcast.
I would certainly rather win at a Worldcon that I was attending, for instance, in Scotland next year. Just saying, sure. If anybody wants to nominate again next year.
And mentioning on other categories, I do want to mention, because I think Olaf will destroy me with his mind if I don't recommend this work, Supergirl, the woman of Tomorrow.
Yes.
Which is up for graphic novel. And he recommended it, and I read it, and I was very impressed. It is not your typical Supergirl story. Supergirl is taking a vacation.
Yeah, it's not set
Krypto.
On Earth. Yeah.
Yes, completely not set on Earth. She's taking a vacation in Krypto, and she encounters a woman who's father has been murdered, and she wants to help her out, try to find her father's murder. But then what's next? What will happen when they find the murder? What should they do? What shouldn't they do?
Yeah.
It's a complex look. It's done by one of the stars of modern comics, definitely modern TV comics. I mean, excuse me, modern comics, right? Not DC comics, Tom King. And it's a beautifully illustrated story. Looked good on my phone when I checked it out at the library. And I think it's just kind of, it's a surprise. It's not your typical superhero story. So I think it'd be a big surprise for anybody who wants to check it out.
I thought it was great. I really enjoyed that one. I'm not sure I think I read some of the Dune graphic novel as well. But my vote went for Supergirl. So.
No, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other closing statements from anyone?
I wouldn't go with a closing statement, but I will say this. How do you find time to read all of these?
Yeah.
I feel quite unread when I come on these. So
I listen on audio when possible. Mm-hmm. Like a number of the things were available on audio from my wonderful library system. Or some people have, memberships and paying things and so on.
Yeah, I similar for me this year. I decided, since I had finished the list that I started out to do, that I would allow myself to do more in audio, because typically I read in print for the podcast. But for this, I just went Known of the Ninth. I haven't read any of the others. I'm probably going to have a hard time getting into it. I'll let somebody else read it to me while I'm on my bike. and so while I was triathlon training this summer, I listened to a lot of audiobooks. And then, yeah, I just basically, I had created a backlog for the first time ever. That was how I was able to read the novels, was I knew that I already had my first two episodes of the post-list Hugo episodes done. Still waiting on doing the third one with Sarah. I have the fourth one done already. so that gave me a little more time. For the short stories, if you just have to dedicate a day and you can usually get through them all if you have access to the packet. But for the longer stuff, yeah, just a matter of making the time.
My advantage is I do have a slight advantage. As I said, a few years ago, I think around the time you started doing your podcast stuff, I started doing this thing. It's like, well, wait a minute, there's more short fiction available. So I just decided to challenge. And then I actually created a database so I could write what I thought about the story. Mm. And then I could print it in my club's newsletter later. I literally program an Access database. So I try to read. Now I've set the goal of trying to read 100 pieces of short fiction between Thanksgiving and March. March is the arbitrary date because that's usually when the ballot is due. So,
right.
But then I also do a thing which I started doing at least since 2012, because I started doing this for my club. I just said, hey, why don't I research and I think what are the recommended books? And I would do this before the Locust list, the Locust magazine comes out for recommended reading lists in February. But I just decided, well, let's do it in January. And I found lists. Actually, one of my early sources was somebody by the name of Charlie Jane Anders, who is the editor of IO9, and she would do a best of. But I only focus on novels.
Mm.
And so I for the last couple of years, I've done this list. One year I couldn't do it because I had an engagement, and I gave my friend copies to give out to people to the club because I couldn't make the January meeting. I had to cancel out. So I do take a look, and I've picked all the Hugo winners. I missed out Sarah Pinsker's Plague novel. I missed out because that slipped under the radar of my sources of where I find like the novels that people are talking about in the year.
Hmm.
This year, for this year's category, the only novel that I did not have in my best of the year stock was The Daughter of Dr. Moreau. I mean, I love Sylvia. Her book Mexican Gothic made my list the year it came out, but it's just like I try to pick a number of books. I try to keep it around 30, and because of Renee Williams, I try to keep it gender balanced. So if you find my list, it's 50-50 men and women. So
yeah.
That lightning bolt won't hit me. So, so that's my, you know, because of my fanish activities, I just get a little bit of an edge in research.
Mm-hmm. And for me too, this year with reading the novels, actually, it took up enough of my time that I didn't do more of these panels, mm-hmm. just because I didn't have the time to do the editing. Cause that's the unseen part on podcasts, about the back end of it. If you don't have a staff, which it's just me. So yeah. But it's fun. It was nice to, you know, this year I'll be able to, whenever the Hugo Award for this year is handed out, it'll be a reread for me, and that'll be fun, because that has not happened very often.
It just occurred to me, if you're an established podcast, could you go to a school and get an intern, you know, in some type of related discipline to help you out?
I mean, I'm sure that I could find somebody to do it for free. I don't know that I would want to exploit someone, so...
Well, doing it for a grade, then.
I
mean,
if it is, yeah, I suppose if it's something where somebody is, you know, I don't want to be that person who's like, you know, do it for the exposure and the experience.
Yeah.
And, I don't want to be that person. Pay people for their work.
But you can do that once you win the Hugo, Seth. You can just they can just say, I've worked with Heth, the Hugo winner.
There we go. Yeah, we'll see. All right.
Well, I think what popped into my brain was. There was that old episode of Seinfeld where somehow Kramer got an intern.
Right. Kramerica Industries. I remember that one. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up then. So thanks, everybody, for doing this. Thank you, Juan. And thank you, Sarah. And thank you, Lacey Jane.
My pleasure, Seth.
Yeah, it was great to have you. And thank you, Ivar, as well.
Thanks, everybody. It was a really good discussion.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again, everybody. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.